I see film titles especially as a missed opportunity, even though actually maybe they don't fit into modern film. I don't know. Or maybe they need to be brought back into independent films, which will then feed back into mainstream. And as with posters, they are being seen, I'm sure, as a purely selling product, which is saying, this is the film, give you as much information as quickly as possible. I mean, the money involved in films now is so vast that nobody's willing to take risks, I don't think.
Artist Supermundane sharing his thoughts on the state of today's movie titles and poster designs. We'll talk to him at MUBI and Stax Art Exhibition soon. Also ahead.
One of my biggest goals with the Hollywood is to turn this into the mecca for Portland cinephiles.
We'll take a front row seat at Portland's stunning Hollywood Theatre to hear why 70mm projections are the complete immersive experience. Plus, we'll kick off a week of documentaries here at Monocle 24 with the man behind a film that explores the often flammable rapport between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley. And later in the program, who was the screen's first superhero? Well, here's a hint. It wasn't Superman or Batman.
Shazam!
That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of movies on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House, I'm Ben Rylan. We've got so much to get through this week, but I want to start off with something slightly different. We were talking here on The Cinema Show last week about Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. Now, the critics certainly haven't been kind to Zack Snyder's epic take on the original superheroes, though it doesn't appear to be damaging its box office in the slightest. Now, despite being visually spectacular, one of the major disappointments for me was the film's lack of any opening sequence. Short of some pearls falling to the ground in slow motion as Batman's backstory is recalled yet again, the film's introduction is oddly sluggish and very quiet for a film that's otherwise one explosion after another. Well, that was one of the topics I discussed with the illustrator known as Supermundane, aka Rob Lowe. He was at this week's opening for a new exhibition called Surprise, a special collaboration between MUBI and Stack magazines at Magma in London's Covent Garden. Some of today's most fascinating artistic identities were given a simple brief. Show us what Surprise looks like. MUBI's in-house team of film experts then assessed the results, throwing each into a neat little box to recall which cinema classics they recalled. Supermundane's piece was a rather bizarre Art Deco pastely graphic, combining lines and patterns into a sort of 1930s stained glass face that, according to MUBI, could be taken right out of Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
When I thought of Surprise, the first thing that came into mind was the open-eyed face of being something, which some people might think has been more shock, but that's how I feel about Surprise often, so... So that's where I started. I started literally with two circles for eyes and a circle for a mouth and built my design around that structure.
I think for a lot of people, they would probably struggle to understand how you can turn one word into a piece of art, but this is something you do quite often. Tell me about your creative process, whether it's the word surprise or whether it's just, you know, any other sort of brief that you get from someone. What are the sorts of things that you draw upon to come up with a visual representation of what is at first merely just a thought?
Often when a lot of my artwork is quite abstract anyway, so I'm often not trying to represent something specifically. So it's quite nice just to have one word brief, because I don't have to then put too much representation in there, which is something that I could do if I'm asked, but it's not always what I'd like to do. I much prefer to kind of work in a purely abstract way and try and get some sort of motion and movement and all these kind of things out of the line and colour that I use.
Now, all of these tie back to movies somehow, but that is something that has been done afterwards. It was very intentional on the part of the brief here that the brief did not include for you to interpret a movie. the interpretation comes after the fact. So when you look at your image and you see that that someone has looked at this and thought, oh, I think of Metropolis, or I think of Enter the Void, or the MGM Lion, what are your thoughts on that? People sort of projecting their thoughts and feelings onto your work. How does that feel for you?
That's something that I really like, because I think that's the most important thing is in a lot of what I do is having an element of ambiguity. I really don't want to be prescriptive and say this is what it is and you've got to look at it and it means what I say it means. So, and actually for them to pick up on Metropolis is it's a great film and it probably has influenced me at some point without me really thinking about it.
So tell me about your thoughts on movie posters in general then, because I know that is something that you feel quite strongly about, not just movie posters, but visual design within the movies themselves. It does feel as though it is something that is not really considered of utmost importance in today's film industry. But looking back to the older days of cinema where all movie posters were drawn by hand and you had often quite a large focus on at least the opening titles in a movie, what are your thoughts on the way that it looks today?
I see film titles especially as a missed opportunity, even though actually maybe they don't fit into modern film. I don't know. Maybe they need to be brought back into independent films, which will then feed back into mainstream. I think, and as with posters, they are being seen, I'm sure, as a purely selling product, which is saying, this is the film, give you as much information as quickly as possible, and get you in. I mean, the money involved in films now is so vast that nobody's willing to take risks, I don't think. So even unusual films still go for quite a standard format. But that might change. I mean, I think book design for a long time went down that route where everything was very formulaic, and that's starting to change. So hopefully there'll be a space for people to produce interest. Because, I mean, it's a beautiful format, a huge poster. What designer or illustrator wouldn't want to work on that, really?
That was the illustrator Supermundane there at Movie and Stack's new surprise exhibition. And if you're in London, head on down to Magma in Covent Garden. It's on there until the 22nd of April. The historic Prohibition-era Hollywood Theatre in northeast Portland, Oregon, is a city favourite known for its indie films and repertory screenings on a 50-foot screen, along with hosting film festivals, an educational programme, and even some live performances too. Once a silent movie cinema, the Hollywood has been reviving another lost period in film history, 70mm film, the large, high-resolution format known for its superior picture and sound quality. Melanie Sevchenko visited the Movie Palace to find out why 70mm is making a subtle comeback and why watching a 70mm film is really the total cinema experience.
It's fair to say that most people who know movies have seen Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece from 1968. This opening sequence is part of pop culture milieu. But how many of us have actually watched it in its original 70mm format?
It's a totally immersive experience.
Dan Halstead is the head programmer at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Bringing back 70mm to the historic Movie Palace last year was his personal project. And the first film they screened in the format? 2001, A Space Odyssey.
People were blown away. You're completely involved in the movie in a different way than you are from digital or 35mm.
70mm film, as you might have guessed, is twice the size of the standard 35mm film. But with that larger format comes a high-resolution quality that cannot be replicated. It's the reason why Dan wanted to share it with his audiences.
One of my biggest goals with the Hollywood is to turn this into the mecca for Portland cinephiles. We really pride ourselves on our film presentation.
Unlike most theaters today, which project only digitally, the Hollywood also screens 35mm prints. So 70mm was the next logical step.
It's the ultimate film format. It's the greatest format you can see a movie in. And so I felt like we were obligated pretty much to bring that back to Portland. And since 70mm did originally play here in the 50s and 60s, it just seemed appropriate.
But sharing that celluloid magic of the past was no easy feat.
We had the 35 millimeter and 70 millimeter projectors here, but all the 70 millimeter parts were gone.
That meant tracking down all the bits and pieces, film gates, lenses, sprockets, from the basements of archives and film collectors. The nonprofit Hollywood even established a fundraising campaign to cover the costs. With dedicated and generous support from Hollywood Theater members and cinephiles alike, they raised $15,000 to install the 70mm upgrade. Dan shows me the projection booth.
Yeah, so this is the original booth. So this theater was built in 1926 when film was still flammable, nitrate film. And so that's why this is the fireproof room. So if the film caught on fire, the audience would be saved. Only the projectionist would die.
The sound of 70mm was also a major selling point for the format. 70mm had been around since the early days of cinema. In the 1950s, Ted A.O. perfected the technology. Then came Super Panavision 70 from the 60s to the 80s. Some of the great classics like Ben-Hur, West Side Story, Lawrence of Arabia, The Sound of Music, and of course, 2001, were shot on 70mm. Yet because of the format's high cost of film and projection system, the studios phased it out. In the 80s, 70mm was largely used for blow-ups, meaning films that were shot on 35mm and then transferred to 70. The benefit was its six-track magnetic sound, which was by far better than any other technology at the time. Here's Joel Miller again.
But then in the early 90s, they figured out how to get six-track digital sound off of 35. And so that pretty much just killed 70.
Some men, nothing is written unless they write it.
Yet lately, 70mm is making a small comeback among those nostalgic for its crisp and riveting image. In 2012, Paul Thomas Anderson shot The Master in 70. Portions of Christopher Nolan's last four films were shot on 70mm, including Inception, The Dark Knight Rises, and Interstellar. And more recently, Quentin Tarantino brought us The Hateful Eight.
Got room for one more?
Last December, the Hollywood screened 60 sold-out shows of The Hateful Eight in 70mm. Tarantino showed up at one screening and surprised the audience with a 30-minute Q&A. In the basement of the Hollywood Theater, Dan Halstead shows me the 70mm reels of The Hateful Eight. Five double reels, each in a metal suitcase with a lock. At 50 pounds, lifting one takes work.
You can go ahead and pick that up.
Both avid 35mm film collectors, Dan Halstead and Tarantino actually borrow from each other's collections. Dan's is also down here in the basement, mostly kung fu and exploitation films.
It was ridiculous to keep it at my house. So
like 70mm, the Hollywood Theater has gone through its own revival. 5 years ago, it was largely run down and audiences were scarce. These days, with new management and programming, the Hollywood is thriving once again and hell-bent on delivering the big screen experience.
Now everybody has widescreen TVs at home, and they have a home theater set up, so you really need something special for people to come out. And there's something about film at 24 frames a second. I watch it happen all the time with audiences. People are more involved in the movie. When they're watching digital, people are talking more, they're checking their phones, they're not as involved. There's something about film that really works with the human mind.
To celebrate the Hollywood Theater's 90th birthday this summer, the Movie Palace will be screening Lawrence of Arabia, Aliens, West Side Story, and 2001 A Space Odyssey, all in 70mm. For Monocle, in Portland, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
Thanks, Melanie. There's really nothing quite like the 70mm cinematic experience. In fact, I recall the former manager of Melbourne's Astor Theatre remarking that saying you've seen a film like Gone with the Wind after watching it on a television screen is a little bit like saying you've seen the Mona Lisa after glancing at a souvenir postcard. Well, that might be a little bit dramatic, but, you know, we filmmakers love a bit of drama. We are creeping ever closer to the Tribeca Film Festival, which kicks off in the magnificent New York City from April 13th. And to get us into the mood, The Cinema Show is teaming up with The Globalist here on Monocle 24 for a week of discussions with some of today's most fascinating voices from the world of documentaries. The series sets things in motion on Monday with 2014's Virunga, an incredible true story of the people who risked their lives to save Africa's oldest national park, dodging civil war and a devastating shortage of natural resources. But if you can't wait until then, we'll whet your appetite now with last year's Best of Enemies, a delicious compilation of the fierce rapport between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley. Looking at the state of political debates today, it's easy to forget a time when TV talking heads were in passionate disagreement and yet somehow maintained an air of intelligence and, well, most of the time, class too. Let's hear now from one of the film's directors, Robert Gordon.
When I was a kid growing up in Memphis, Tennessee, on Sunday mornings there were three TV stations. We'd get up to watch cartoons, you know, and we'd be up too early. So the first one would have a preacher on it, the second one would have a preacher on it, and the third one would have Bill Buckley sort of languishing across the screen with curly cues of cigarette smoke going up and these funny looks on his face. So I didn't understand what he was saying, but I was immediately taken by his performance. Vidal, I didn't encounter on a personal level in my youth, more that his series of historical novels were in everyone's library. And I would just always be aware of him and what he was doing. But I didn't really encounter him until later.
Bill Buckley was the first modern conservative to see that ideological debates were cultural debates.
Mr. Buckley, do you think miniskirts are in good taste?
On you, I think they are.
The people at ABC asked him, well, is there anybody you wouldn't go on with? And he said, the only one I can think of is Gore Vidal.
Gore Vidal is one of America's most successful and distinguished writers.
We are all prostitutes in one sense or another, ethically, if not sexually.
They met face-to-face really fairly infrequently. You know, they had a feud in the newspaper in the early 1960s. They were on TV on, you know, a couple late night shows in the early 60s, kind of bashing each other. There's no video of them from 1964. And then the only other time that they encountered each other were these 10 meetings that we made the documentary from in 1968. I knew about this in college in the early 1980s. I was very into literary feuds. So I knew about these debates and I'd kind of forgotten about them until a friend of mine in 2010 shared a bootleg DVD he had of the debates. And seeing it all afresh, you know, as a grown man, I was just blown away by all the undercurrents that were happening.
Mr. Vidal's suggestion that perhaps it would be in our interest to support Ho Chi Minh suggests perhaps also that as a matter of testamentary integrity, I reveal a concrete proposal to that end contained in a letter sent to me by Senator Kennedy about 6 months ago, the PS of which was, I have changed my platform for 1968 from let's give blood to the Viet Cong to let's give Gore Vidal to the Viet Cong.
May I see that, really?
I think, however, that would be immoderate.
We were really interested in it initially as a political divide. But what the research revealed was that there would be economic result. More people tuned in, the angrier they got. The networks took the message that audiences want to see people fighting on TV. You know, previously, television discussions had been very restrained. And if there was an argument, it was a polite argument. There's nothing polite about the way these two guys interact. I mean, it's one diss after the other. And they're beautiful disses, you know. One calls the other the Marie Antoinette of the right wing, you know. It's just like, you can't just get it. You have to bring your own knowledge to it.
The only sort of pro or crypto Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
Buckley and Vidal were arguing about life and death matters in a life and death kind of way. They really wanted to change people. It wasn't like, and everything was different then, you know. It wasn't a Fox News audience being fed what it wanted to hear. There were only three networks at the time, and you could change people's minds. Now, you know, you're just preaching to the choir mostly. So Buckley and Vidal were out to change people's minds, and Morgan Neville and I, my film partner and I, were out to help people see the emptiness that they're sold every day as content. And we wanted people to demand a return to real public intellectual thought. And also, you know, these guys are funny. What we're talking about is all very serious, but these guys really had a fun time kind of putting each other down in a very snippy, smart way. And now, you know, it's just the disses aren't funny, they're embarrassing.
Robert Gordon there, chatting to us from Memphis. He's one of the directors of 2015's Best of Enemies. And we'll have more from the world of documentaries all this week on The Globalist and next week here on The Cinema Show too. Still to come today, who was the screen's first superhero? We'll find out next.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI, the curated movie side of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And if you're listening to this program, chances are you're a passionate devotee to quality movies. Well, here's some good news for you. A whole month of MUBI for free. Strictly for listeners of The Cinema Show, you can head now to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle to redeem that very, very special offer. As MUBI always says, life is too short for bad films. And it's also too short for bad special effects. Unless, of course, you were Columbia Pictures back in the 1940s, which is where we'll head now. Back in the 1940s, televisions were not exactly commonplace in households across the US. But the talking picture was just over 10 years old, and it had quickly carved a place as the leisure activity of choice for any cultured urban dweller. In fact, Americans were spending about 23% of their recreational income on visits to the cinema. That's about 90 million sessions every week. But the cinema wasn't just about movies. Newsreels often played a part in disseminating world events via moving pictures. But serials were often just as integral to the cinema ecosystem as any of the biggest movies too. Usually consisting of about 12 chapters running at around 15 minutes each, the genre really acted as a precursor to the Western adventures that eventually found their way to television. It could be said that the benchmark for the cinema's serial was really set by Flash Gordon. That 13-part epic adaptation of the famous science fiction comic strip attracted an enormous following, with its genius use of miniatures to create some of the most striking visuals ever yet seen. A sequence involving the hero battling a giant reptilian creature is quite mesmerizing, making clever use of a split-screen effect mixed with an actual lizard. Flash Gordon was made in the late 1930s by Universal, which was then a much smaller player than the big five studios that dominated Hollywood, such as MGM or Warner Brothers. But if Universal was small, Republic Pictures barely registered by comparison. They were part of what was somewhat unfortunately referred to as Poverty Row. Unlike most of its figurative neighbours, however, Republic had some fairly lofty ambitions. If Universal could strike gold with a children's comic strip hero, surely they could too. Less than 5 years after Superman first flew onto newsstands, Republic approached National Periodical Publications, a precursor to today's DC Comics, with the idea of Superman taking flight on the big screen. They'd even prepared a script, but National proved a little cold on the plans. The idea was shelved and the script instead became 1940's mysterious Dr. Satan. But Republic were confident that they were onto a winning idea. And National wasn't the only superhero publisher in town. A deal was struck with rival Fawcett Comics to instead bring their most popular hero to cinemas. And with a bang and a puff of smoke, Captain Marvel arrived. Throughout the 1940s, Captain Marvel became the world's most popular superhero, even outselling Superman less than a decade after his creation. That was no doubt helped by Republic's spectacular treatment of the hero. In its first episode, the serial sets the stage with young Billy Batson assisting on an archaeological expedition deep into the Asian jungle. Along with some fellow explorers, an ancient artifact known as the Golden Scorpion is discovered in a crypt.
What on earth is it?
Well, that's hard to say.
Well, these are lenses of a sort.
They're probably a fused quartz of some kind.
Well, if this is the dreaded secret of the Scorpion dynasty, it seems to be quite harmless now.
The Scorpion holds great powers, but the crypt warns visitors not to enter. Unlike his colleagues, Billy obeys the order, and as an explosion causes the ancient building to crumble, a mysterious wizard appears. Known as Shazam, the wizard bestows great powers on the young boy.
So long as the Golden Scorpion may fall into the hands of selfish men, it is the duty of Captain Marvel to protect the innocent from its evil use.
But who is Captain Marvel?
You are, my son. All that is necessary is to repeat my name, Shazam.
With the utterance of one word, young Billy Batson could quickly transform into the world's mightiest mortal, Captain Marvel.
Shazam!
Like most serials of the time, the plot here, well, it's fairly formulaic. The audience was, of course, primarily boys around the age of 12. But what's most striking, however, is the wonderfully simple method used to make Captain Marvel fly. The process came from the brothers Howard and Theodore Lydecker. Put simply, a dummy was made in the rough likeness of Tom Tyler, the actor who plays Captain Marvel. It would then slide along a wire with the scene shot from a distance. If it all sounds very amateurish and simplistic, well, by today's standards, it was. But the scenes, well, they're all available online. Take a look. It makes for some really, truly incredible cinema. Especially when compared to the crude animation technique employed by Columbia's Superman serials, which aren't really considered classics by anyone, and for good reason. Sadly, this was the only time Captain Marvel starred in a serial, and up until now, it's the only time he's made it onto the cinema screen. That will obviously change, but in an age of all manner of superheroes streaking across screens of all kinds, it's worth looking back at a time when a lack of technological prowess forced filmmakers to really think about what real adventure and what real surprise looks like. That's it for this week. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yorleen Goffin. Now, if you're curious about what surprise looks like, do head on over to Magma in London's Covent Garden. If you're not in London, well, you can always settle in for a quality movie. There's bound to be a surprise or two waiting for you. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com and be sure to subscribe to the podcast as well. I'm Ben Ryland. The Cinema Show returns next week. Thanks for listening.